Welcome to the Full Totness Breakfast on SoundHard Radio 102.5 FM with myself, Peter Sheeran. How are you today? Well, thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, we will be joined by our eminent MP, Conservative Party, Anthony Magnall. And he will be joining us in a few minutes. And we'll be, well, we've got lots to talk about, a lot to talk about. I've got lots of subjects. I'm going to try and keep it all tidy as much as I can. Bear in mind, I'm not John Humphreys. I'll be doing best I can. The music today, we've got a couple of tracks chosen by Anthony, but I've filled in with a couple. So we'll start with that, one of Anthony's songs, and we will talk to him directly after. And Devils and Angels by Rufus Wayne. I can't say his name properly. Rufus Wainwright.
Hatred on the horizon must be assumed, for the ascension shatter the scepter, lower the drawbridge, drain the moat, empty the catapult. Hatred on the horizon must be assumed, for the ascension unlock the padlock, swallow the key. For any prisoners, there won't be any need. Hatred on the horizon must be assumed, for the ascension. Sit down and wait. Wait on the throne for it to take and for the beast to come. Devils, devils and angels.
I'm gonna get
Devils and Angels by Rufus Wainwright, and that was chosen by Anthony Mangle, MP, who is with us here this morning. Good morning, Anthony.
Morning, Peter. Thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. Now then, we got a lot to cover, but one thing I wanted to ask you is you're, well, not so new now, but a relatively new MP, stomping up into Parliament. What the hell's that like? Must be weird.
It's definitely weird. I mean, I definitely don't feel like a newbie. I feel like an old hand, because throughout the pandemic, I'm one of only seven MPs that has continued to go to Westminster and has never given up his vote or used the virtual system. I've always viewed my constituents and the population pay for MPs to go to Westminster, and it's important that we are there to scrutinise and ensure that we pass good legislation. So it's been extremely weird over the last 15 months to be in a building that really doesn't have many of its sort of regular occupants, because throughout most of the lockdowns, there are only about 20 of us there. So that's been extremely strange, but it's an enormous privilege to be able to go up to Westminster, to be able to fly the flag for South Devon. But it comes with its challenges, and I think the difficulties is trying to find the balance between supporting the government on lots of things, as I do, but also standing your ground and presenting your principles up front and centre, which I've done on a number of occasions on issues that are really close to my heart.
I was going to ask
you, and you've got to get that balance.
Yeah, and I'm going to get on to that. The I've got a technical question about it, but also just if there's 20 MPs stomping around that massive building, I mean, you must feel like you own the gaff, don't you?
I don't think anyone ever feels like you own it. I mean, it's you have to respect the building and what it signifies. And it is an extraordinary parliament that has served as the example to many others across the world. And it has to be respected. I think, you know, one or two times you can forget that. And what I'm always very conscious of is that when you sit in that chamber, the people who came before you and the people who come after you, and all politicians are here today and gone tomorrow, as was famously said. But it is really important that when we look and listen to the legislation and the debates that are taking part, that we make sure we pass legislation that works, is enforceable, is understandable, and we respect it, whether you win or lose. And that, to me, means that it's not something where you take it for granted that it's your place, but that it's the population's place. It's the population's palace, as it were.
You take me on to a question then. With a place of that magnitude and what it represents, is it okay to lie in Parliament?
Well, if you lie in Parliament, you are held to account, and you can be brought before the liaison committee. The Speaker can call you out on it. You can even be named as a result of poor behaviour in the chamber of the House of Commons. I've always taken the view that, you know, you must be there to debate and scrutinise and hold your own government to account, the opposition parties to account, and hold people who are there to account.
Mm. And Dawn Butler, was she right or wrong to call out what Boris Johnson had been doing?
I think, you know, you don't call people a liar in the chamber because you generally don't. It's very poor form, which is why Dawn was asked to leave for the day. I don't think she was right to call the Prime Minister a liar. I mean, I think people make a whole range of statements in the House, and whether or not you agree with them, that doesn't necessarily make them a liar. But she clearly has her view. I don't agree with it, and neither does the Speaker, which is why she was asked to leave the House.
Full fact, have checked his statements. They got I've got a list of 10 here that is clearly untrue, the things he said. So that's not a case of opinion. That's actually a state of truth or not truth.
It depends on what's being said. I mean, is it untrue because it's a fact that has changed, or is it untrue because it's deliberate obfuscation? I think that's the difference. And I think we have to be very careful about how we bandy around terms like lie.
Mm. I won't go into all these, but I've got a whole list. But I don't want to talk about Boris Johnson, I want to talk about you. So the thing you lost recently... to my mind, sadly, I was fully on side with your view on this, because the regular listener will know that I rant about all sorts of things the first thing in the morning when we start this show. And one of them, which I feel very strongly about, is foreign aid. Now, that didn't go well for you.
No, I mean, it's one of those painful moments in Westminster where I am, you know, I lost the debate. I lost the ability to persuade a number of people who I thought were with me. And had we had the vote a month ago, which is when we were trying to do it with an amendment to a bill called the ARIA Bill, we would have won it. Unfortunately, in that time, colleagues were persuaded that the new mechanism was the right thing to do. And the new mechanism says that 0.7%, the foreign aid budget, will return to its full level or its previously agreed level if we end borrowing for day-to-day spending and when the national debt begins to fall. And of course, over the course of COVID, we've borrowed a huge amount, and it is understandable that the belt has to be taken, or the belt has to be tightened somewhere. However, from my point of view, and I've spent a great deal of time working, you know, with various foreign secretaries in the past, I've seen this as something that we've done extraordinarily well. It will come back and cost us a lot more because of the cuts now. And the UK is a global leader in this area. It's not jingoistic to say that. It is a reality. Mm. We have an extraordinary impact around the world, and we have made we have had an extraordinary influence around the world in getting other countries to follow suit. I'm just sorry I didn't have the strength of argument to persuade others to stick with me, but I felt I was in good company on that one.
Yeah, in terms of the machinations of Parliament and how it works, you say if you did it a month earlier, you think you're confident you would have won that argument.
Yes.
Is that infuriating in that if you go from one moment to another and suddenly the rules have changed and therefore you don't get what is actually essential passed through?
Well, I mean, arguably, if you were asking, let's just do a hypothetical. If we had done it a month ago and you had a government minister on, he would be saying probably exactly the same as I am, but from reverse. You know, we tried to get the government on the hoof and surprise them with our action over the ARIA bill. We failed because that amendment wasn't called. The government then did exactly the same back to us and called it on the short, and we weren't prepared. I mean, we thought we had the numbers going into it, and as the day went on, we suddenly recognised that we didn't. And the Chancellor has offered a compromise, and he's a decent man, and he's a good Chancellor, and I've spoken to him about it since. And, you know, I will now concentrate my efforts to helping get it back to 0.7%, and also in the meantime making sure that we can make sure the money that is being spent is directed to the right places and the places most in need. But it is frustrating. You know, you don't win everything, and you also have to accept that when you don't win, you have to not forget the issue, not drop it, but you have to move on. You have to accept parliamentary democracy. Mm. And that is the nature of it. So I take it on the chin, and you live and learn, and hopefully I will be able to hone my argument to make it more persuasive in future years on this subject and others.
Yeah. Now, moving on to another subject for you, something like that, for example, you must put a lot of effort, because your speech was very erudite about the whole thing, which I saw. And you have to go into a lot of detail and a lot of research on that subject in order to make a speech about it. Then you have to do another, you have to cover all these different subjects as an MP. And in order to sympathise with what you have to do, that's a huge onerous task, having to cover all these different subjects.
Well, it is, and it's very nice of you to say that it was an erudite speech. It was much more emotional than I perhaps wanted it to be.
Well, that's why. I should have said emotional, but yeah, passionate. Let's say passionate.
I think it's a good thing. I mean, the point to remember is that in Westminster is not a place in which you give speeches. It is a place in which you debate. And it's really important. It's not a platform from standing up and reading a speech that you've written 10 days before. It's a place in which you debate what has been said before you, what is in the bill, what is being discussed. What I do find is that, you know, that as time goes on, your expertise or your knowledge in different areas increases. So, you know, I didn't know a great deal about water gradations before I became an MP. Now I would say I'm pretty good at it, and can speak quite comfortably on it for unlimited amounts of time, but don't worry, I won't do that now. But I find that because you go out and you engage so much, and when Parliament isn't sitting, I spend my weekdays and my weekends going to see different groups and having different conversations, not all of whom I agree with, but they make their points of view, and I make fastidious notes and action points, and I learn from them. And so when the debates do come up, I can stand up and recall the stuff that they've told me, but also input it into the debates that we have as well. And I hope that's effective. I mean, I hope people feel that they've got a strong voice down here in me, and that that they can come and see me, and I can try and raise their issues in the Houses of Parliament, which is the privilege that I get to be able to do for them.
Mm. And Totnes, well, all constituents to me seem, or constituencies, sorry, all constituencies to me seem absolutely huge for one person to represent in Parliament. Is that something you agree with, or do you think
depends? I mean, comparatively, if you take them, if you compare them to a congressman in a congressman or woman in America, they have a constituency base of 300,000 or 400,000, or a U.S. senator, of which there are two for every state, in which they have millions. So it does depend. I mean, we are now the Boundary Commission is coming through at the moment. They are doing a review of all the constituencies and their sizes.
Uh-oh.
and they're trying to get them around about 75,000. So every constituency will be about the same size.
Well, that keeps happening, doesn't it? That's your gerrymandering.
It's always happened. The Boundary Commission is by requirement of law meant to report every 10 years. So this happened under Labour as well. And so it's not a case of necessarily being that. I mean, it doesn't make a huge amount of difference, I believe, in the Southwest. It does elsewhere. But it's good that we have equal size constituencies. I think the only place that doesn't change is the Isle of Wight, which is a huge constituency, and to stop it from being split into two constituencies on the island itself.
Right, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, that's probably sensible, isn't it? And there aren't that many people on the space, though, are there?
I don't know. I may be wrong. Maybe one of your listeners can tell me. Off the top of my head, I don't know what the electorate is, but I think it's plus 100,000.
I can do research during the next song. Let's find. I'll do that. Now then, more locally, the Southams District Council. Now they have made, because I mean, Totnes as a town and not as a constituency, we seem to be under siege from developers. And it very much feels like a siege. We're battling off housing developments on a regular basis. And Southams District Council produced a response to the planning white paper. Mm-hmm. How it was quite robust, let's put it that way, and made some arguments very much against the plans in the white paper.
Yes.
Do you back that, or do you have differences?
No, I back that. I mean, I work really closely with councillors. I think it's really important that MPs, Devon County councillors and district councillors all work incredibly closely together, and town councillors and parish councils for that matter. So no, I do back what they said, and I speak with the planning team at Southampton District Council quite regularly, because we obviously, the white paper is not the law, and it's a guide to what the legislation might look like, but it also serves in one respect as a consultation. And there were two parts to it. There was the white paper that talked about zonal areas, of which you would have a growth area, a protected area, and a possible area, as it were. And then there was also what was then deemed the housing algorithm, which was suddenly going to see thousands more homes put onto the idea of a required build in this area. Thankfully, because of people like Judy Pearce in Southampton District Council and her team, and officials as well, we were able to make the case that the housing algorithm number was completely way off, because there is a good joint local plan. You know, Southampton with Plymouth have come up with an arrangement to make sure that we're building in the right place, that we're not overbuilding, and hopefully this can serve as an example elsewhere. Where my concerns are really around the planning legislation as it comes forward later in the autumn. I don't have a date for when it comes forward, but I'm very keen to see that legislation, and up until I see it, everything's a bit of a guess, because I don't know what's going to be in it. But I have had lots of engagement with government ministers. I've seen Robert Jenrick, who's the Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government. I've seen Chris Pincher, who's the Minister for Housing. So I'm constantly sort of engaged with this. And I also, I've got a call this afternoon with the Kingsbridge Group on housing. I speak to lots of people in Totnes on housing. I'm very engaged on it, because we've got to get it right. And in my view, we are in a housing emergency. And I don't say that lightly, but I think we are in a housing emergency. When the rental market is incredibly reduced, if any of your listeners right now are on have the Rightmove app, I suggest they type in Southampton and have a look at how many houses are for rent Rightmove, because they'll find 19 versus 396 on Airbnb in and around Totnes town, wow, versus 300 and something around Kingsbridge versus 400 in Solcombe. So we've got to be very clear about creating a market that allows local people who work in the area to be able to afford and live here, not just to become a destination for second home. So sorry, there is so much in that, because there is the way in which we build, there's also the way in which we deal with second homes. But sorry, I don't want to hijack your interview.
No, it's not at all. It's absolutely fine. That's the way we work. That's the way we roll on this program. No, but Selcombe, I understand, have got a thing going with preventing second homes, haven't they? Haven't they just...
Yes. So on Tuesday this week, and this is one of, you know, this is why it's great. We've got a strong council that is doing good things. Basically, all new homes in Solcombe are going to be built with the requirement of being principal residencies. Now, it is going to be required. It's basically going to put a covenant on future build properties to make sure that if they are sold, so I could buy. Well, I can't buy, but if one could buy a house in Solcombe, you would have to live there as your principal residence. And if you were then to sell it, it would have to be sold as a principal residence. It couldn't be used as a holiday home. It couldn't be used as a second home.
And that's from now on, is it?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
And how do we enforce things like that? Because I guess Jeff Bezos could say, yes, I live in Selcombe all the time, but he doesn't. Is there a way of checking on that?
Well, so, I mean, there are requirements that, there are sort of not boxes that are ticked, but there are a whole load of requirements to show that you are living in a principal residence. Your post is sent, it's where you're registered as a doctor, it's where you register your doctor services, it's where you pay your council tax. So, and actually the council has a lot of power on this, and they have enforcement power on it as well. So actually they can make life difficult for those who don't want to follow those sort of rules. Okay. But the point is it's finding this balance. I don't want to see residents priced out of their own area, and I also don't want to find ourselves suddenly just becoming a playground for people who can afford second homes. I want us to be the extraordinary community that we are in each of the different towns in South Devon, and Peter, it's an incredibly special place to live, and we're very lucky to be here.
It's awesome.
But I'm not going to sit idly by while people get pushed out of the area because someone wants to Airbnb their property. I don't think that's right. I think we've got to find innovative solutions to deal with this.
Yeah, and now I understand that I don't have any facts on this, but I've heard through the grapevine that a development in Totnes was passed, even though the Southhams District Council planners all were against it. But they passed it due to developers having the ability to take them to court, and the Southhams District Council couldn't defend themselves against a court action. So they passed the development anyway.
I wish I could give you an answer, but I don't actually know the instances of that case. Just on a slightly separate note, there's a really interesting example in Kingsbridge of where a developer is trying to develop a wholly unsuitable site, and the development is going ahead, but they haven't done the required procedure to proceed with the development. And so Southhams is actually stepping up and putting an enforcement notice on that site not to continue building. The developers are going to continue doing so. And Southhams is standing its ground in a way that I'm really pleased to say, because developers shouldn't be able to bully their way through and override the views of local communities, which is why we have neighbourhood plans, but also listening to councils as well. So I'm very bullish when it comes to developers, because for too long they've had it their way. I want to make sure we're building in the right way and in the appropriate style and with the proper quality. But with the instances of what's happened in Totnes, I'm afraid I just don't know the details on that issue.
That's fair enough. But this thing in Selcombe with this removal of second homes, or not removal of them, but reduction and not allowing them to happen, can that happen here?
Yes, I mean, it certainly can. There is a requirement depending on what the percentage of second homes are in place already. So if I think it has to hit over a certain threshold before they can start doing that. But at the same time, it is also worth looking at the data that over the last 13, 14 months, quite a lot of houses that have been sold are actually changing back into primary residences because people don't want to live in the cities anymore. So, you know, there is a small and gradual change already. And the other thing that I'm really pleased about and that I hope is going to make an impact is closing this loophole around second homeowners being able to claim for business rates. If you own a second home, you should pay council tax. It should be the base position that if you own a second home, you can't escape paying council tax. And frankly, you know, whether or not that level is the same as owning another house or should be slightly higher is up for debate and discussion. But the point is that we've got to change those overly generous positions that are there in place. And I'm really pleased that the Chancellor listened to me and a few other Southwest MPs, but I'm really pleased that I led that campaign. And that law is going to be changed and there's going to be a further announcement about it in the autumn. But it is making a difference and we have to keep fighting. It is quite granular and detailed in different respects, but it means just keeping moving the sort of inching forward to change it and to make sure we're not hollowing out our communities. And I really feel strongly about that.
Fair enough. Yeah. Okay. Let's have a bit of music because it's 8:30 already. Blimey. The speed of the show is amazing. You've chosen the song by The Weeknd and we're going to go with Blinding Lights. Blinding Lights, and that was chosen by Anthony Magnall, MP, who is here with us this morning. And there we go, the talking heads, they might come later. There you are, I told you, my DJing skills, they completely collapsed there. Now then, you have made a statement. I've been doing some research. I know it's going to shock some people. The regular listener will be shocked. South Ham's newspapers, you made a statement for them about housing. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you said was brownfield sites must come first. I'm just paraphrasing and just jumping in these. Neighbourhood plans must be enshrined. We've already discussed that. Infrastructure must be in place before building begins. That's another point you made. And fourth, you said affordable home targets must not be watered down. So affordable homes must be available, which you already covered in the last segment. And of course, that takes us on to the development that seems to fulfil all those statements that you made, which is, of course, Atmos.
Yes.
What do you make of what's going on? Because, now, before I let you go there, there's been some criticism going on. Judy Pearce made a unilateral statement that the planning has been withdrawn from Atmos. And I think there's a bit of a shock horror probe thing going on with that. What do you make of what's going on?
I mean, listen, it is, of course, a crying shame that Atmos haven't been able to develop the site, and that's because it's been sold from under their feet. But I've only just received the legal documents that they had in terms of an agreement with the Dairycrest site, or Dairycrest owners, sorry, and I'm trying to understand whether or not they were blindsided or whether or not this agreement was never there. Judy the leader of Southamptonshire Council and Southamptonshire Council have said there is no ability to plan because they never took any action to build anything, and there are rules. It's not, you can't have sort of individual rules for individual areas. Mm. And because there was no beginning or start of any development, the Atmos site have now lost their development rights on that site because they never even dug a trench or put up a building or put up a thing. And that is unfortunate, but that is the way planning rules are put in place. I mean, it's also one of the things that stops a big developer from land banking a piece of land for 50 years. Mm. If they don't do anything with it over a period of time, they lose their right to be able to develop on it.
Yeah. According to a statement from TCDS, Totnes Community Development Society, they made a point, and I'm going to paraphrase because I haven't got it in front of me, but they said that they had a meeting with South Ham's planners in July 2021, which is this month, and they thought everything had been agreed at that meeting, and they've been a bit blindsided by the sudden...
I mean, you have to remember, MPs don't have a role in planning and planning decisions, and the discussions go on. I mean, I follow it because I think the TCDS group are a great group. I think it's also right that we have a very strong community engagement in the way in which we build. But I can't speak to the meeting that they had. But my understanding is that if you don't use, if you're granted planning permission, and you don't use it over a period of time. Mm. It does expire, and that's my understanding of it. So, I am sorry, and I am looking into this sort of stuff, and I'll continue to, I'll continue to support the idea of community development because it's the right thing to do, and that site itself is crying out for development. It's just perfect, and it could provide extraordinary amounts of space for people to set up businesses, for people to live in and be able to commute to Exeter and Plymouth. It is a terrific site, and the sentiment and the spirit of what Atmos Group are doing is something I wholeheartedly support. And I spoke with them I think last week, and I am there to engage with them, and I do get the frustration, but it's not looking particularly positive for them, and I'm afraid I don't quite know what the root cause of this is, but whether or not it's because there wasn't a legal agreement in place, whether or not it's because the decisions weren't taken, but a lot of time has passed and a lot of money has changed hands as well on it. And I hope the site will be developed because it's an eyesore now, and it's a death trap. And it's awful to hear about the poor gentleman who died there not that long ago. So
indeed, that was a hideous tragedy there. Moving on, you what does this is a technical question now. It's about Parliament. What does no when you vote no on something, and you're a teller, why aren't you included in the figures of the no side when you make a vote?
Because it's very annoying, this, by the way, because if we had won it, I would have been the one that stands at the sort of in the chamber and reads out the results. So because it was my rebellion on 0.7%, I am required, I basically put myself forward to count in the no's who were with me. So I was counting in all the opposition MPs, but also all the Conservative MPs who were on my side of it. And you are essentially cancelled out by the government side that is on the yes side. But it means you're, I don't know if it's the appropriate way to put it, but you're the sort of leader of the no's, essentially. But it just means you're counting them through. But you don't get registered as no in the sort of voted against. But if you're looking at it on theyworkforyou.com,
yeah.
You are put as the teller for the no's, which means you're with the no's.
That's bizarre. Yeah. That's absolutely bizarre. So you're the leader of that no campaign, and then you don't appear on the voting register as being a no. That's
you are there as no, because now we're having this discussion. If you come up as a teller for the no's, it means you voted no.
So, right. Well, I've learned something.
Exactly. It's like the same reason you don't. I mean, it's sort of, there are all sorts of weird and wonderful procedures, but there is a reason, rhyme and reason for it, just for the same reason that we don't call colleagues by their names. You have to, you know, there's all sorts of different sort of pieces of history that link into the sentiment of the whole place.
Sure. Well, another subject that you're very hot on is modern slavery. Now, what's the motivation for you for this?
Well, I do a great deal, as you know, Peter, on sort of development, human rights, this side of things. I really care about it. I think it makes a great difference. And I think a lot of people around the world do also expect Westminster to take a lead on these areas. And Theresa May, when she was Home Secretary, introduced the Modern Slavery Act. And the Modern Slavery Act has this section, which I think is, if anyone is reading it, is Section 54, Part 2. And Section 54, Part 2 talks about modern slavery in supply chains. And we're all familiar with the clothing brand Boohoo, which was found to have slaves, basically slave labor in its supply chains in the UK a few years back. And one of the concerns I have is that Boohoo was a company that was sort of Class A rated by banks as a good investment prospect.
Okay.
And that really frustrates me, because why is a bank not doing its due diligence on a company that was quite blatantly, in many instances, creating this extraordinary and appalling work environment and breaking the law, both national and international? And so what I'm looking at the moment, it's not necessarily coming into law. What we're trying to do is we're trying to find out whether or not it is worthwhile to amend the Modern Slavery Act to include investments, so that a bank cannot use its huge capital at its disposal to invest in a business that might be perpetrating slavery.
Mm. And with moral investing, are they doing their due diligence on these things? Can we trust those banks that say we're ethical banking and all that sort of thing? Does that affect this situation?
That's a really good question, because actually, you know, one of the things I've seen over the last few weeks is that, not last few weeks, last few years, is that, you know, the move from corporate social responsibility has now moved to environment, social and governance. And ESG, as it's known, that environment, social and governance, is extraordinarily prominent now in the operations of banks and financial institutions around the world. And I think that's really welcome. But you're absolutely right. You know, we do have to make sure that there is ethical investment. And I've been very interested in seeing some of those stockbrokers, some of those banking institutions, some of those financial institutions that are now moving away from, say, poor environmental investments to making sure that they're pushing a green agenda towards they're doing this stuff. So it's not beyond them. But what I have also found is that when I come and speak to all the different banks on modern slavery, they are incredibly supportive and very, very keen to help. I think I've spoken to nearly all of the high street banks. I've spoken to some of the merchant banks already. I haven't had a single one say, no, this isn't something we want to have a hand in. They're all very, very actively engaged. But the point is there's no point passing legislation unless there is a real issue. So we're pushing to hold a consultation. We're working with the Home Office Minister, Victoria Atkins. And I hope, you know, we can do some good and help some people. But we're still in the sort of investigation stage and trying to figure out how extensive, if at all, this issue is.
So we've still got a way to go then on this subject. And
sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, you're going to continue campaigning, and do you need to get the law changed?
I need to understand how big the issue is. I mean, clearly, I think there is an issue; otherwise, I wouldn't have started pushing on it in the first place. But the passing a law is a really important point of principle, in the sense that you don't just introduce laws for the sake of it. I don't think the British population is well served by needless laws. I think what we have to do is make sure that we're passing it for the right reasons, and that we're introducing it for the right reasons, because there is a problem. So I think the next step is we're going to collate our evidence. I've written a couple of articles about it recently with Gareth Davies, the MP for Grantham and Stamford. One to watch, by the way, Peter, a future rising star of the Conservative Party. If that fills you with any hope or dread, I don't know. And what we're going to do is collate that information, probably run a consultation with financial services, with financial authorities as well, and work with groups like Unseen to see what's out there. But once those findings come back, then hopefully we'll take the steps from it. But I don't want to sort of preempt it, because I don't know what the findings are going to be. Certainly there's an interest and an enthusiasm for us to do this.
Sure.
But I haven't seen huge data that says it's a systemic problem.
Okay. Well, moving on to, we've got another subject to kick into. Now, the Conservative Party are effectively, it seems to me, I've done a few rants on it of a morning, privatising the NHS. Now, what's your response to that?
How so?
Putting things into private, public initiatives like... sourcing goods for the NHS is being set off into private companies, that sort of thing. American investment companies coming over to the UK following Brexit.
There's not much detail there, but I mean, if you're saying private and public cooperation, I think that's a good thing. I mean, that's why we have the vaccines that we have, because there was private and public cooperation to create AstraZeneca. So I'm afraid I don't at all agree with you that the NHS is being privatised. The NHS will remain free at the point of use for all British citizens, and I don't think it is being privatised in the slightest.
Okay. Let's get more local. The MIU, we had David Matthews on the show on Tuesday, I think it was. And
yes.
It's been closed a long time. Do we know when it's going to reopen? Because we've been promised it is.
I know that there was a gathering on Saturday to call for it reopening. I'm really pleased that people decided to do that, because I heard that it was going ahead. I'm sorry I couldn't join members, but I spoke to Torbay Trust, spoken to the CCG, the Clinical Commissioning Group, as well about this. They are hiring staff. It will be reopened. I don't have an exact date. I have been told in a few months. I did ask whether or not a few months meant 2, 5, 8, 12. I was told it was between 2 and 3 months. So I understand we're looking at the autumn.
Right. And why was it closed in the first place? Do we know?
COVID, because of basically the uptick in requirements, both at Exeter, RD&E, Torbay, Derriford, and the Nightingale Hospital. There was a draw to staff there to be able to deal at the height of the pandemic with the massive strain there. That's why they've done it. I mean, I should also say I've written a number of times, because I write every 2 weeks for Totnes Times. I've made a real point about rural healthcare. It would be remiss of any, it would be very stupid of any CCG or trust or health secretary to try and remove any health structures in our area any further. Totnes MIU makes a massive difference. It's hugely important. And I will fight tooth and nail to make sure not only is it returned in the time frame that I've been given, but that people are confident that it will be well served and have the right staffing levels as well. So it's been really frustrating to see it close, and it's been really difficult for some people who have turned up, you know, expecting or hoping for some help, and to find that it's closed and they can't get, and they have to drive all the way to Newton Abbot, or go to Torbay. So it's really difficult, and I do share that frustration. And of course, if I had it my way, I wouldn't have had it ever allowed it to get closed. But I wasn't entirely sure what I could say to someone who said, "We need the staffing in these hospitals to get through this pandemic." And I, you know, that is an understandable point as well.
Well, considering, I mean, Dartmouth, for example, I think that's the extreme example. If you break your arm in Dartmouth, what do you do next?
Well, one road in and a ferry that closes at 11 o'clock. You're really stuck. I mean, the closure of Cottage Hospital is a real source of angst and regret, not because it didn't happen in my time. But what I'm now working on is making sure that the Health and Wellbeing Centre, which we broke ground on a few weeks ago, I mean, literally, I think 3 weeks ago, and will be open in the latter stage of next year, is going to be quite a comprehensive unit. But actually, I want it to go further. I want to see whether or not we can get an X-ray unit to at least be in Dartmouth on certain days of the year, or indeed full time. I've spoken to the health secretary about this. I spoke to Matt Hancock about it. Now I'm speaking to Sajid Javid about it. I'm working with the local community to make sure that we can upgrade some of the services on offer there, and see what we can do. But it's a real source of frustration, because it's a big town. It has lots of visitors. And the loss of the Cottage Hospital is really upsets people. It upsets me. You know, it's deeply worrying. And you know, I don't live far from Dartmouth, and you sometimes find that if you're driving on that road at night, it doesn't take someone much to, if there's an accident, you're cutting off an entire town, and the alternative is a very long route round.
And it's a windy road, that as well. So accidents are pretty much inevitable at some point or other.
Yeah. So, but I mean, the ambulance side. I mean, what we're trying to do, and what the trusts are doing, is we've upgraded the ambulance services in Dartmouth so that they have a quicker response time. We're going to make sure we've got a good health and wellbeing centre there. We're working with the care homes there as well. So over the course of COVID, there were 16 step-down beds. So for rest and recuperation, so those who were being treated elsewhere could come back and rest and recuperate in their own towns. It's finding models like that that can work, and also and basically making sure that people are comfortable with the services that are provided. And I'm really conscious that lots of people in Totnes with the MIU have been really uncomfortable about having it closed. And my office is next door to it. It's been really concerning, and I hear those, and I continue to push. And I should say, if any of your listeners would like to talk to me about it, my office and I'm open at any time, and would be very happy to speak to anyone on this issue or any others.
Rightio, good, thank you. Now we're running out of time. We're hitting the end of the show, so thank you very much for being with us. I've got one last question, and it's procedural in terms of Parliament. Now, it's one thing that bugs me, because I do watch, because I have to go out on a Wednesday afternoon, so I do watch Prime Minister's questions every week, pretty much, and I end up sort of just screaming at the telly. But the one that gets me probably most wound up is that question that basically goes, after Keir Starmer's had a go, not a very good one, but he's had a go, there's always a question from the Conservative side saying something like, does the Prime Minister agree with me that Bourbon is the best Dunkin' biscuit for a coffee? What is that about?
All sides sort of do it to their own leaders. I'm afraid I don't do it, which is probably why I'm not in the greatest favour with either the Prime Minister or the whips, for that matter. There was a great quote from Betty Boothroyd. She was interviewed. Betty Boothroyd was interviewed, that amazing Labour speaker and the first female speaker of the House of Commons, extraordinary woman. And she reminded everyone, and I think it's really important, this, that it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you sit on, which political party you come from, your job in Westminster is to hold the government to account, because the government, while being the executive, still has to answer to Parliament. And answering planted questions of saying, does the Prime Minister not agree with me that, you know, Totnes is the most beautiful town and area in the country, which of course is true.
Obviously,
obviously true. There's no point to it. There's no point in me asking that question. The better question is, does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's absolutely outrageous that Totnes MIU is not open? Will he do everything he can to help get it reopened? And that then gives a kick up the arse to the Health Secretary to move things along.
Yeah.
that's sort of where it has to be. I'm with you on the frustration, but that it is sort of, it's a little bit of the pantomime of the way in which Westminster works. But I would say the majority of us need answers to our questions. We don't need to be told that we're champions of our constituency. That's up for you to decide. We need to be given answers that we are able to come back that help answer your inquiries and allow you to see that we're doing the work that is required as your local MP. Mm. But yeah, it frustrates me as well, because you want answers. And someone else's question can often give you a good answer to an issue that you might be concerned about.
Well, I'll leave that in your hands to sort out in Parliament for us and make it so. And so thank you very much, Anthony Magnall, for joining us on the show this morning. It's been a pleasure having you on the programme.
Peter, thank you for having me.
And we're going to play out with Horizon by the Heavenly Post, which is a band with Gilbert Gabriel, a local musician and good friend, actually, Horizon. Thank you for listening, folks. We'll be back tomorrow.
Hear all that's left.